Thank you, Diane, for that really thorough introduction. So today I'm going to talk about a project I've been working on and off since 2006, in between my book project and teaching and all that, on the history of the institutional response to homelessness in the U.S. And in this talk today, I'm going to discuss the role that the social and behavioral sciences have played in characterizing homelessness and homeless populations. So for my research, I've conducted two rounds of interviews with researchers, policymakers, and homeless advocates. And in this process, I sought to identify people who are involved in the institutional and research response to homelessness through snowball sampling. And I've supplemented these interviews with archival research and research involving news databases and social scientific literature and government reports. So according to all this research, when do social and behavioral sciences become involved with homelessness? Well, we can go back all the way to the 1870s. You can situate the beginning of what I call the science of homelessness with the emergence of the tramp as a recognized social type in late 19th century America. And you see from this picture, there's this poor tramp begging at the door of this householder in what looks like a sort of semi-rural area with tattered clothes, and yet he doesn't look so threatening to us. Does he look threatening to you? Not really. But this lady is terrified of him. In fact, even her dog is terrified of him. So what's the story here? And when I first saw that, I wondered, why is she so terrified? And why did she open the door if she's so terrified? What's going on? Well, in fact, at this time, during the turbulent depression years of the 1870s, there was a Great Depression of the 1870s that thrust millions of men into unemployment. And coincidentally, this is when we just completed the Transcontinental Railroad. So these men, unlike previous generations, hopped on freight cars, rode the rails, and just went across the country looking for whatever kind of job they could possibly find, getting some kind of seasonal labor on a farm or in a mine or harvesting. And in between, they were starving, they were begging, occasionally they were stealing. But these men were considered a dangerous class by the bourgeois, the voices that were dominating the newspapers and social reform literature. And part of it was because they were untied to the discipline of family and home and the moral constraints of work, which was work, wage work then was pretty brutal, no weekend. And they were blamed for everything, from labor unrest to rape and murder. And if you go through the newspapers, they're always being portrayed as rapists and murderers. So the forerunner of the modern day homeless individual did not start out as a positively characterized or sympathetically characterized social type. Now in 1891, John James McCook, who is a minister and sociologist at Trinity College in Hartford, decided to do a survey on the tramp to find out what were these men really about. And this was kind of a turning point where, rather than just assuming that these men were, you know, murderers and thieves like and rapists like the newspaper said, to interview them. And so he sent out these surveys to 24 cities, and he got to mayors and police chiefs. And his sampling frame was not something that would be acceptable today, but he did get back quite a lot of data. And he found that these tramps were mainly single men, mainly white men, more Catholic than Protestant, unemployed, and intemperate. That's what he focused on, that they were drunk. And he was part of the temperance movement, conveniently, so he focused on temperance, outlawing alcohol as a solution. Now, moving forward to the 19-teens and 1920s, there had been these roving unemployed men were not just riding the rails, but they would congregate in certain neighborhoods of cities, which became known as Skid Row districts, or in New York there was the Bowery. And missions and other areas of services for these men developed in these neighborhoods. The men would stay at what they called flap houses, patronize brothels and saloons, and most importantly, this was a place to get hired by a labor agent for your next round of work. So these men were very much a part of the economy of building the West, harvesting the West, exploiting mines and factories. They were migrant laborers. Now, one of the Chicago School sociologists, Nels Anderson, specialized in what he called the hobo because he claimed to have been a hobo himself when he was young. And instead of calling this social type the hobo, he said that we should call this person the homeless man. And this was actually the first attempt you see in the scientific literature to really destigmatize this group of people. And Anderson portrayed these men sympathetically as hardworking, if also hard-drinking men, who created this egalitarian alternative to the constraints of Victorian domesticity. But again, his view privileged the individual and cultural aspects of what was then homelessness over the structural aspects. He didn't look at uneven unemployment, poor wages, lack of access to education, and the lack of the social safety net. Now, during the Great Depression, these Skid Row districts swelled with men who were unemployed, but unemployed men were everywhere. This is in Haddon Heights, New Jersey. And this massive unemployment and homelessness was seen by the general population finally as something that needed to be addressed through government action. And of course, the New Deal came along, and there were New Deal employment programs that did absorb some of these men into, for example, the WPA. But really, this tide was really only stemmed by the beginning of World War II and the full employment and the draft. Now, after World War II, the GI Bill provided free education and cheap mortgages with no down payment for many of the 16 million returning vets. And so in some ways, it prevented a whole generation from falling into homelessness. However, it widened the gap between black and white, because black vets born in the South, gained nothing from the GI Bill due to segregation of colleges, including my own university, University of Maryland. They were not able to benefit from the educational benefits, and they were also excluded from these suburbs, which were, the creation of the middle class happened there by restrictive covenants, by racial segregation. Meanwhile, in the cities, in the Skid Row districts, there were these remaining populations of aging, they were mainly too old to go into World War II, men, many of whom were plagued by alcohol abuse. And this population that was dwindling and aging suddenly became the subject of intense sociological study in the late 1950s. So why did this happen? Well, because you had urban renewal. Cities around the country were paying sociologists to study these men of Skid Row because they wanted to know what to do with them when the bulldozer came. And many residents, were displaced by this so-called urban renewal, and this included the residents of most Skid Rows, except in Los Angeles, where they were just contained. However, this did not in itself lead to an increase in homelessness. These men often were displaced to marginal housing elsewhere in the city. And in fact, in the mid-1970s, despite the fact that we were in an economic and fiscal crisis, there was very little apparent homelessness in the United States. My young students can't believe that there was a time when you didn't see homeless people on the streets. Can some of you remember that time? When you didn't see a bunch of homeless people on the streets? You remember that time? It wasn't. Yes, President Carter actually, if you look at his speeches, homelessness was discussed as something that happened to people who were having natural disasters happen to them. That was homelessness. And in fact, this author, Anthony Jackson, who was a scholar of housing, could say with credibility in 1976 that the housing industry trades on the knowledge that no Western country can politically afford to permit its citizens to sleep on the streets. Flash forward to 1979, and there are mentally ill people sitting, quote, disheveled and apparently disoriented, as this New York Times article says, on park benches and sidewalks around New York City. And through 1981, the New York Times often referred to members of this group as, quote, vagrants. And there's, you see this real ambiguity between this older construct of the vagrant, which incorporates sort of the other constructs of the tramp, the hobo, the skid row bum, with this newer fluid construct of these seemingly disoriented people, people with mental health issues living out on the streets. And in my interviews, I found that people who were trying to research this population during the early 1980s talked about how they first tried to apply the Skid Row sociology and psychiatric studies of Skid Row men to this new population, and of course it didn't fit. You had women, you had many men who were suffering severe mental illness, and the population was more racially diverse, more age diverse than the Skid Row population. So between 1979 and 1981, you had this dynamic phenomenon emerging that was yet unnamed. And this is when social science again comes in. In 1980, you had two anthropology graduate students, Kim Hopper and Ellen Baxter, who were commissioned by the Community Service Society in New York to do an ethnographic report on these people living in the street. And when they released the report, Private Lives, Public Spaces, in March 1981, they got the New York Times to write a front page Sunday article about the report. And in the report, they emphasized again and again the housing aspect and made a conscious effort to refer to the people in the report as homeless. In an interview, Kim Hopper has said to me how they consciously chose to revive this old term to really construct the problem as one fundamentally of housing and not just mental illness. And so when the New York Times splashed this headline across its front page, it really changed the social construction of the problem, at least in New York. Jack Krauskopf, who was a New York City commissioner at the time, told me in the interview that this story is sort of what defined it as a homelessness issue and not just a power issue. The issue of mental illness, however, hovered at the forefront. In January 1982, some of you may remember, a woman named Rebecca Smith froze to death on the corner of 10th Avenue and 17th Street in New York City, just a few hours before city officials were going to get a court order to hospitalize her. And interviews with Smith's family, media interviews, emphasized that she was a, quote, beautiful, college-age, educated woman who, after 10 years in a mental hospital, had left her husband and daughter because she didn't want to burden them, and that her diagnosis was schizophrenia. And this event really brought the issue of homelessness and mental illness not only to the attention of New Yorkers, but to the national media. Quote, this is what happens when you cut social services, a Washington Post writer bluntly opined. People like Rebecca Smith die. Because this event occurred almost immediately following the new Reagan administration's dramatic 1981 budget cuts in social services, it became a symbol of everything that liberal America did not like about the new president. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., a Catholic left advocacy group called the Community for Creative Nonviolence had been trying to raise attention to this issue for several years. And in December 1981, they planted a field of white wooden crosses in Lafayette Park across from the White House. And each cross represented someone who died, quote, homeless and alone over the previous 6 years in the U.S. And they set up a tent city, and they called it Reaganville, like the Hoovervilles of the Depression. And this group was led by the dynamic and charismatic activist Mitch Snyder, who's pictured here. And according to Snyder's later recollections, the Rebecca Smith case really galvanized media attention toward their cause. Now, in 1980, the CCNV had estimated that there were 2 to 3 million people who were experiencing homelessness nationwide, that it wasn't just a New York problem. But they didn't have trained, credentialed researchers. This number was a back-of-the-envelope estimate that came from a telephone survey of service and shelter providers conducted by Mary Ellen Holmes, a CCNV member. And at first, there were also no federal government figures, because the Reagan administration insisted this was a state and local problem, not a federal problem. But eventually, in 1984, under pressure, the Department of Housing and Urban Development came out with an estimate of 250,000 to 400,000, which was so much lower than the CCNV estimate that Snyder went on a hunger strike to protest the report and demand that it be withdrawn. So there was a vigorous debate about how many homeless people there were in the United States, but also about who homeless people were and what they needed. Were they state hospital patients who'd been released without sufficient services, or were they people, poor people, who just needed housing and were being really, pushed out in the street by the Reagan recession? Now, I'm going to skip through this a little. In New York, there was what you call blame game, that the mayor basically said, oh, it was the state hospitals, and the governor said, no, it's the housing policies, you're converting marginal SRO housing into condominiums. In the psychiatric literature, there was a debate about whether homelessness was a mental health problem or not, and this article got quite a lot of flack because it said it was. And in 1982, meanwhile, quietly, this federal agency, the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration, became involved. And this was a real sort of under-the-radar program from these officials at these three agencies. And it was interesting because Adam Ha had been repeatedly targeted for cuts by the Reagan administration. By the early 1980s, there was sort of a feeling among some leading policymakers in this area that, oh, Adam Ha was separate, and it wasn't quite as good as NIH, and it didn't do just pure research. So the Reagan administration was very suspicious of it for doing what they called social research. But in this climate, this group of institutes managed to fund 10 single city studies that looked at the prevalence of homelessness and the prevalence of substance abuse, severe mental illness, and other factors among homeless populations in these seven cities in Ohio. And these cross-sectional and longitudinal studies were conducted between 1983 and 86. And even though the total amount of funding for these studies was less than $2 million, they really exerted a significant influence over the understanding of the nature and the scope of homelessness by researchers. In fact, these studies, along with a group of homeless demonstration projects on healthcare for the homeless, sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, became, quote, the primary scholarly work in this area, according to a later assessment by researchers. Along with early privately funded studies, they comprised the first generation of homelessness research. So what did they find? Well, I'm going to skip forward here for time's sake. But basically, they found that, yes, homelessness for some was a mental health problem in a third to a half of the cases, but guess what? The majority of the people experiencing homeless are not severely mentally ill. This was a radical finding that was resisted by the NIMH director. Is homelessness a housing issue? Yes, but it's also related to employment, substance abuse, mental and physical health for some. And while these things, to those of you who work in the homelessness field, may seem obvious, at the time they were not. The bottom line from these studies was it showed that people experiencing homelessness were a socially diverse population with multiple service needs. Now, the New York studies, which were the largest studies, really showed that there was this subgroup, and I won't go into it, but there was a subgroup of people who had mental illness, prior shelter use, problems with employment, and this really started to lead to what was called the chronic homeless subtype. And this was later confirmed in the 1990s by longitudinal studies conducted by Dennis Culhane and others. Now, what this has led to is, on one hand, a tailoring of services and programs to different subpopulations, within the homeless, the greater homeless population. You have, you know, the people and families, individuals, chronic, family households, veterans, youth. If you work in homeless services, you know that there are all these different subtypes. But I would argue that in addition to helping service providers to tailor their programs, which they've done effectively, they also managed to actually fragment the idea of homelessness, fragment homelessness, and really bring forward the earlier trend in social and behavioral science to characterize homelessness as a problem of persons, or in this case, a set of problems of different subgroups of persons, and really to divert attention away from problems that relate to the social structure or the safety net. Sociologist Cynthia Bogard, in her book on the emergence of contemporary homelessness in New York and Washington, D.C., noted that homeless people are a very diverse lot, but had one shared problem, the lack of regular housing that was appropriate, available, and affordable for them. But so little of homeless social policy, and I would say social research on homelessness, had to do with housing in the early years, and so much had to do with the presumed individual deficiencies of people experiencing homelessness. And I think in closing, we have to remember this, that homelessness ultimately has to do with the lack of affordable housing for people and people's inability to afford housing. It's a structural problem, and that while scientific studies can inform policymakers and program directors about what type of housing assistance works for which subgroup, permanent supportive housing, housing first for chronically homeless, vouchers to get temporary housing assistance for transitionally homeless families and individuals, homelessness is not going to go away until we address it head on as a whole problem and not just pick and choose the little fragments of specialized sub-problems that we want to address. Thank you.